You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on November 12th, 2013 from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. Ahead this hour, guest expert Abby Stoddard from Humanitarian Outcomes joins me to discuss a new report on violence against humanitarian aid workers around the world. Then I look at problems on the Keystone pipelines. Finally, I ask why we cannot even have a debate on guns. All this is just ahead on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Tuesdays at billhumphreyresearch.com/radio and from iTunes and other locations. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Email us at afdradio@gmail.com or call and leave a message with your views and questions at 347-688-6676. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. I'm Bill Humphrey. You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy. My guest today is Abby Stoddard from Humanitarian Outcomes, which just released its 2013 Aid Worker Security Report. Abby, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
First off, could you tell us a little bit about your group and what your aims were with this report?
Sure. Humanitarian Outcomes is a small group of independent researchers. We're all former aid workers. And for the past several years, we've been studying, among other things, attacks, acts of violence against aid workers, and compiling the data together on a database that we call the Aid Worker Security Database.
So historically in conflicts, we think of humanitarian aid workers as occupying a sort of neutral, unaffiliated space that everyone would respect because they were helping everyone. But that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. And that was one of the things that came up in this report and the reports from previous years. The top finding in this year's report from your group was that the number of attacks on humanitarian aid workers around the world, as well as the rate of attacks per worker in those hotspots, had both increased, continuing a trend from the past few years. So could you walk us through what this means in practice and what some of the other major findings were this year?
Sure. Attacks on aid workers are increasing over the long term. We've seen that, and that's not only because there are more aid workers in more dangerous places, but the highest numbers of attacks are in a very small number of contexts. So in 2012, there were 167 major attacks against aid workers, which we count as killings, kidnappings, and armed attacks that result in serious injuries. And those victims of those attacks totaled 274 aid workers. Now, it's the largest number of individual attacks that we've seen since we started recording this data. It goes back to 1997. And there's a number of reasons why these few hotspots tend to see more attacks against aid workers who, as you say, are meant to be neutral and apolitical. In some cases, it's because of the existence of militants using the tactics of asymmetric warfare. When you have a militant group that's overpowered by a government or occupying forces, they'll naturally aim at soft targets. Aid workers are often seen by these militants to be associated with, or at least indirectly assisting, either the government or the occupying forces in their political and military agendas. And they're also just often the closest and easiest targets. So that's especially the case in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Right. And so to that point about sort of the association that they get with the occupying force, even if it's not their intention, earlier this year, you had written an article for theglobalist.com in which I believe you were arguing that the modern counterinsurgency strategies that we've seen in places like Afghanistan, where this seems to be particularly bad, and those are often called hearts and minds campaigns, might actually, in fact, be increasing the danger for the humanitarian aid workers because that humanitarian aid starts becoming associated from the insurgent perspective with the occupying force that's trying to win over the people as opposed to being a neutral party. So could you explain a little bit more about how that relationship works and how the attitude toward the aid workers has changed given the military's shifting philosophies?
Most aid organizations want very much to have themselves perceived as neutral, as not working for any force, but helping everyone. And that's sort of the classical humanitarian model a la the ICRC. When you have governments involved in a conflict, say the United States in Afghanistan, who often are the major funders of a lot of these aid organizations, the lines naturally become blurred. And some aid organizations themselves have made the situation worse by closely cooperating with parties to the conflict and not underscoring their independence and neutrality. And it doesn't help when politicians say things like Colin Powell famously did, that they're using the NGOs as force multipliers in Afghanistan.
It seems like the, you know, the military is trying to co-opt these neutral NGOs to the detriment of those groups, because then they become seen as sort of legitimate targets almost.
That's right. If they're seen directly advancing the interests of the opposing party, then the militants can very well say, as the Taliban has said, that these are legitimate targets in some cases.
What typically is the security situation for these workers? Like, do they have members of the military or private security contractors, or is anybody, you know, out there stationed with them, or are they typically just on their own?
Well, the typical humanitarian organizations, most of them tend to avoid any kind of armed security or any presence of military in most places. There are also private for-profit contractors that work on the larger reconstruction projects. They tend to have much more close association with U.S. forces and private security companies that are heavily armed. And it's a very different approach and defensive posture than a typical humanitarian agency would have.
Right. So given that they usually don't have security, I think this leads to one of the other key areas of the report, which was about that kidnappings in particular have been on the rise. There was some discussion in the report about ways to mitigate that or handle that better or prevent against it. And it sounded like a lot of the time, they have pretty complicated procedures in place in these groups to try to prevent it. But a lot of times it's sort of an opportunistic attack. Somebody, you know, lets their guard down or something and then gets taken.
Yeah, that's true. Now, kidnapping, I should say, is a particularly complex and challenging and potentially very damaging incident for an aid organization, even more than a killing sometimes. It can be protracted, you know, lasting for months or even years. It's incredibly stressful for everybody involved. It's costly in terms of both resources and staff, time, and energy. And the whole thing is often taking place in the public eye. So in terms of what agencies can do, aid organizations have professionalized over the years in their security strategies and protocols. So apart from just getting staff to establish and adhere to prevention measures to avoid the kidnapping risk, there are areas where they need to get better. And for one, there's what we said in our report, there's a real critical need for new thinking on security on the road. Now, over half of the attacks on aid workers generally take place in kind of an ambush context on the road. And so just getting people and materials from point A to point B safely is a real challenge. And it's one where people seem stymied on really how to improve security. A lot of policy thinking and procedures and investments of security resources go into security at sites, sort of at compounds and project sites, because that's what people know how to do. But there's a real need for innovation around transport and travel.
So there were two kind of main forms that I saw mentioned in the report. There was the opportunistic kidnappings and then sort of the overwhelming force kidnappings. So
right.
Is there kind of a difference in how those should be, you know, prevented against or can be prevented against?
Well, one thing that most agencies are doing is kind of more generally is having negotiated access and an acceptance, what we call an active acceptance strategy to their work. So that means talking with everyone, not only the local community and leaders, but also the potential sources of threat, reaching out and negotiating their way in, making it very clear what they're doing, the fact that they're not aligned with any political forces, and just constantly reaching out and cultivating these acceptance relationships. Apart from that, if there's going to be an overwhelming force type of kidnapping with perhaps explosives and an armed raid, there's little you can do to prevent that beyond, you know, the site security that's already in place. It's the opportunistic kidnappings, the kind of the road ambush kidnappings that we think maybe a lot of improvements can be made if there's new thinking around it.
So it sounds like in terms of the active acceptance strategy there, the idea is that you can prevent a kidnapping much more easily by persuading everyone in advance not to kidnap you, as opposed to trying to vary your route up or, you know, follow all kinds of protocols or whatever to keep from getting ambushed.
Well, that's right. And if you have good acceptance in the local community, you will be warned if there's a kidnapping threat against you. Or, you know, it's interesting what's happening in Afghanistan in a lot of these kidnappings is aid workers are being kidnapped and detained and questioned for a few days and then usually released at the intervention of local community leaders who kind of appeal to the Taliban to these guys are okay. Let them stay. Let them work. We need these services. And so these are being done what we call as almost an informal registration system by the militant groups who are maybe in control or want to be in control of that local area and don't know this aid organization yet and want to make sure, you know, they're not spies or just to find out what they're doing and just to flex their muscles. So these kidnappings are, in a sense, both a measure of the level of acceptance that an organization has and just a signal of how much more work they need to do in terms of negotiating their secure access.
Now, given that kidnapping seem to be the form of attack against aid workers that's risen the most, I think most people think of it in terms of once it's happened, you know, or is there going to be a ransom? And this report points to that it's more complicated than just a cash payment. It might involve various concessions being made either by the group or by governments, the national government or international governments, you know, and that those are sort of non-monetary ransoms. They might include prisoner releases, for example. But the cash ransom, of course, seems to be a pretty lucrative tactic by militant groups all over the world these days. There was a recent Stratfor report that was cited by the BBC estimating that Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb in North Africa had earned well in excess of $100 million just in the past 10 years alone from getting ransoms paid out from kidnapped Europeans. And the group's leadership was going around bragging, saying that they were getting more money from Europe than from the Gulf states. So obviously, you know, that actually makes a lot of people, and especially the British and U.S. leadership, think that there should be very strict, you know, policies against any kind of ransom payments, because clearly it's encouraging the groups to do that. And the report, you had said in the report that a lot of these groups publicly have a no ransom policy, but it doesn't necessarily hold up in practice. Or alternatively, it doesn't seem to be doing anything to have that policy. It's not deterring these attacks. So where do we find a balance in there in terms of, you know, defending against the kidnappings and discouraging them, but also getting their people back safe and sound?
Yeah, well, it's really the most difficult issue regarding kidnapping, because, of course, every time a ransom is paid, it incentivizes future kidnappings. And everybody states publicly that they don't pay ransom. And as our report says, privately, many do. But even for the organizations that steadfastly refuse to pay ransom, the fact that there are other organizations and certainly some governments that have paid ransom means that those incentives are perpetuated. And, you know, a kidnapper might not discriminate between one Western organization and another, or they might not believe their claims of not paying ransom. There are many organizations that have kidnap and ransom insurance, which don't necessarily use the benefits to pay ransom, but rather to manage the crisis and to negotiate. And even if a ransom is paid, one thing they can do is it sounds actually a bit cruel for the victim, but to draw it out a bit so that they're not known as a quick and easy mark. So that's maybe some deterrence in the future as well. But until governments and organizations have a a sort of hard united line against paying ransom, it's going to be very, very difficult. And as we say, it's, you know, it's clear that kidnappings have not yet been deterred by the organizations and governments that don't pay ransom. There's really little else you can do.
So given the overall increase in violence against aid workers and specifically these kidnappings, are we seeing aid organizations pulling back broadly or in specific cases, or are they, you know, still staying the course in these areas?
It depends on the organization. Those that have established very good and professional and sort of automatically systems that automatically kick in for crisis management and a kidnapping, they can stay the course usually, and a kidnapping no longer means that they have to completely cease operations and pull out of an area. But other organizations, it's a very traumatic event. It's usually one that causes a temporary cessation of operations, if not a complete withdrawal. And so you do see humanitarian access and coverage in a lot of places where there used to be many more organizations and projects shrinking steadily.
Well, thank you so much, Abby, for coming on the show. If anyone wants to read the full report, it's available from the website.
Aidworkersecurity.org.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here on Arsenal for Democracy.
Thank you very much.
Arsenal for Democracy will return in just a moment. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm Bill Humphrey. One of the topics that's come up periodically on this show is the Keystone XL pipeline, which would add a second pipeline route to bring Canadian tar sands oil down from Alberta to the Gulf of Mexico, crossing a lot of U.S. states and environmentally sensitive areas. Originally, the route plans included crossing the huge Ogallala Aquifer in Nebraska, which provides drinking and irrigation water from 10,000-year-old reserves for the entire region. Any contamination there would permanently and catastrophically violate the integrity of that water supply, essentially permanently. So that understandably inspired a lot of bipartisan opposition within the state, although they managed to get the Republicans back on board by agreeing to consider rerouting it. But because of these concerns in general, and because of opposition to easing the flow of the highly climate-warming Canadian tar sands oil, a lot of activists in the United States have mobilized against the project. Their big leverage point, which has kept the project unfinished so far and not carrying any oil, is that the U.S. State Department under the Obama administration has to approve the section of the pipeline crossing from Canada into the United States. The original Keystone pipeline was approved by the Bush administration, but the secondary pipeline proposed later and known as XL wasn't due for consideration until after Obama had taken office, thus providing the window of opportunity for the environmentalists. TransCanada, the company which owns the pipeline and is trying to finish it, has pitched this project to the United States and particularly Republicans in Washington as a jobs creator. Although the oil jobs themselves are in Canada, and the pipeline construction jobs are short-lived, mobile, and nearly done. Once completed, there won't be many employees working on this pipeline on a regular basis, as we've talked about before on this show. And, as it turns out, they've actually been able to build most of the XL pipeline already by first building the U.S.-only sections, which is mostly subject to state laws and some federal approval, but not as much approval as is required for the international part. And then finally, they're going to build the transnational section that they've left for last if they get approval from the State Department, but they haven't gotten that yet. Incidentally, that means that the U.S.-only side is mostly already in place, so that jobs argument is kind of over already because the jobs part is going to be wrapping up soon. But as it turns out, there have been some problems with the part of the project that they have already completed as well. In the past, we saw the assurances of big oil that offshore oil drilling, for example, was extremely safe right before BP's Deepwater Horizon rig exploded and filled the Gulf of Mexico with crude oil. Now we're finding out that the industry's assurances that the pipeline isn't a huge environmental disaster waiting to happen and waiting to be turned on is probably a bit suspect as well. As it turns out, according to a Climate Progress article by Emily Atkin on November 12th and a report by a consumer rights nonprofit called Public Citizen, there have been tons of problems with the XL pipeline even without any oil running through it yet, as well as with the already active original Keystone pipeline that was approved under the Bush administration. TransCanada hasn't really been publicizing this, obviously, but both pipelines run for many hundreds of miles across a lot of private land, usually leased in some capacity from landowners, ranchers, or farmers to the company. And these landowners are the ones reporting a lot of curious facts about the state of the current XL project, as well as the active Keystone line. The pipeline is mostly being put into place underground, where it will be quite hard to detect problems and major leaks. We've seen what happens with other pipelines that can leak a lot of oil for weeks, months, or even years into the surrounding soil, contaminating that soil and the water aquifers below. TransCanada has clearly been installing pipelines more poorly than even the usual industry negligence, according to landowner accounts. Even without oil flowing to put it to a true test, the company has had to repeatedly dig up portions of the pipeline to check for dents that can cause significant flow problems, and even to patch outright holes. The pipes, according to this report, are bending, sagging, and peeling, leaving the pipeline at risk of both small oil leaks and significant ruptures once oil actually starts flowing through them. The pipeline has been buried in many places for only a few months, but reportedly there have already had to be over 125 excavations made within just a 250-mile stretch of pipeline that covers hundreds and hundreds of miles of the U.S. heartland. TransCanada doesn't seem to have a very good environmental and safety operational track record in general. The same report found that the already active Keystone line had 12 oil spills during its first year of carrying oil from Canada into the United States. They also noted that during the construction of that earlier line, the company had to do 47, quote, anomaly tests in four different states, which are very similar to the anomaly tests that they're doing now, digging up sections that they seem to think have a problem and finding in many cases that they do have problems. And they're doing that on a bigger scale for the XL line, which indicates that the already bad pipeline is soon going to be joined by an even worse one, as predicted by the environmentalists, if it receives State Department approval. The company also had a major explosion in a natural gas pipeline in Canada in 2011. Now, I know that's natural gas, which isn't the same as oil, but all of that adds up to a major question mark over the company's repeated and specific assertions that their pipeline technology in general is less vulnerable to problems and is heavily reinforced and therefore won't cause all the problems that the environmentalists are asserting are going to happen. It looks like the folks at TransCanada essentially haven't progressed far from their bad old days in the 1990s when four execs at a subsidiary company had to plead guilty to knowingly violating environmental and safety requirements in their pipeline construction permits. There's more in the Think Progress article and the Public Citizen report about what government regulators could do to figure out how bad or fixable this project in fact is. But at a minimum, it's raising some pretty serious safety questions that deserve answers. And I think we're very lucky that the State Department hasn't yet given a green light to the project's completion, because this company has a poor track record, and this project clearly already has a lot of serious problems to resolve. And, you know, it just goes to show that this jobs argument to justify anything really just doesn't cut it. And you can make an argument, you can bend over backwards, you can manipulate the numbers, and you can try to show how jobs are going to be created with almost any of these policy ideas when they're not popular, but ultimately those usually turn out to be wildly or significantly overstated, and there are usually all these other problems associated that cause net social detriment and harms all across the board. This is a serious problem that is already happening without them even pumping oil through the pipeline. In the case of their existing pipeline, they haven't even had it in place that long, pumping oil through it, and they've been getting some pretty nasty results all across the country. And I just can't stress this enough. When you're playing around with these deep aquifers, it's not a simple matter of, oops, we spilled a little oil. That means that you've now put oil in significant quantities into a huge aquifer that doesn't get recharged very often. I mean, they're hopefully going to be rerouting it to not go across the Ogallala Aquifer, but initially they wanted to, and that's a 10,000-year aquifer. That means that some of the water that's been in there has been in there for 10,000 years, and if you emptied it out, it would take another 10,000 years to fill it back up again. That's how long that water's been in there. And there's numerous other environmental problems that that aquifer is already dealing with, but it doesn't need to have oil dumped into it. And that's just the biggest of the potential problems that could be truly catastrophic for the entire region. Why are we willing to put our nation's breadbasket at risk, especially in a time like this with all these problems going on in the world and the potential harms of climate change already threatening these crops, not to mention groundwater mining that's already depleted a lot of aquifers in the region? This is just yet another headache that we don't need to be adding to the pile at this point. The Keystone XL pipeline is clearly riddled with problems, and it's going to make the climate change problem worse. There's a lot of reasons to say no to this project and completing it and letting it go forward. There's really not a lot of reasons to say yes. Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment from BillHumphreyResearch.com/radio and WVUD. I'm Bill Humphrey. A couple weeks ago here on Arsenal for Democracy, I took some time to speak at length about the issue of gun control in this country, or rather not even the issue so much as the lack of debate on gun control. There was, of course, not long after that segment, yet another mass shooting. But setting aside for the purposes of discussion these mass shooting incidents, I would argue that there is a much larger problem in the United States right now. There are people who don't have guns, there are people who do have guns, and everyone in both of those groups breaks down into different opinions on the topic of gun ownership and gun control. There are people who are very adamantly opposed to any gun ownership. There are people who are very adamantly opposed to any forms of gun control. There are reasonable gun owners and reasonable non-gun owners who want some sort of compromise. But as I said on the previous episode where I discussed this a couple weeks ago, we're at a point now in the United States where we seem to not be able to even have a discussion on debating gun control policies. And as I said on that episode, I also don't even feel at this point that I necessarily have a specific policy position regarding gun control that I'm willing to put forth at this point or endorse or anything like that. I think that there were some reasonable bills in many state legislatures earlier this year, and there was a reasonable bill going through Congress that unfortunately has not succeeded and failed in its Senate vote. But it's not about these specific policies anymore. My feeling is that if I'm going to be supportive of gun control as a reasonable person in a 21st century modern society, some form of gun control, to me, it's not even so much anymore about a specific policy. It's about the right to be able to debate this as an issue. As I talked about on that previous episode, in a democracy, you should be able to have a free exchange of ideas. Everyone should be able to express their opinions on some policy matter and debate the merits for and against implementing those policies. Again, as long as it doesn't affect someone's fundamental, immutable human identity, and, you know, and that you're not severely infringing on someone's freedom in a very real and meaningful way. And in my opinion, and I guess you could even debate that point, but in my opinion, a lot of the gun ownership stuff is legal and fine up to a point and should be and is protected by our constitutional freedoms. But then if there are some controls in place, that's not a tangible impact in most cases on people's real freedom. That's not a genuine and serious impact. Because if you are keeping your guns on the claim that you use them for hunting or for crime protection, that's one thing. But you also hear people who are insisting that having these controls would somehow prevent them from leading an armed insurrection against the United States government if it became tyrannical. And of course, they throw around that word tyranny a lot, which makes it even more worrisome. And then you get guys who walk into an airport and start shooting federal officers because they are, you know, opposed to the government, or they walk into a shopping mall and shoot a member of Congress in the head. the people who are shouting the loudest about how they are afraid that their guns are going to get taken away and that they, you know, that the government can't take away their guns because that would be infringing on their fundamental freedoms, even if only some of the guns were taken away. Those are the people who seem to need their guns taken away the most. There are a lot of reasonable gun owners out there. I really wish that they would speak up and speak louder on this and make their voices heard against the legions of crazy people that are dominating the discussion. But again, it's not even just dominating the discussion. It's silencing debate. In a functioning democracy, we all need to be able to express our opinions, whether it's for gun control or against gun control or for a specific policy or against a specific policy. Everyone should be able to be heard. I agree that the people who own guns, whether they're for home protection or they're protection out on the street late at night or, you know, hunting legacy that's traditional in their family, whether it's their conviction that they need to have a lot of big assault rifles because somehow they're going to fight off the world's greatest military by themselves when they decide that it's tyrannical. You know, they don't necessarily all deserve to get their way, but everyone deserves to be heard. And this cuts both ways. The gun control side deserves to be heard, and the gun advocacy side deserves to be heard. Everyone deserves to be heard in this debate. I think that's fair in a functioning liberal democracy. But that is not the situation that we are seeing right now. Instead, we are seeing a situation right now where we are experiencing an inability to have debate. There is total and complete silence. And one side is doing the silencing, as I said on the previous episode. But we got a great, spectacular example crystallizing for me the problem here. That this just happened in the past several days. There was an article on Think Progress reporting this from a group, Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. The short name is Moms Demand Action. They have branches all over the country. They're a gun control advocacy group, and they were having a meeting in Dallas, Texas. And this group, Moms Demand Action, which was formed after the Sandy Hook tragedy, was just having a meeting, just, you know, expressing their own opinions privately. It wasn't even a public, you know, advocacy event. It wasn't a rally for gun control. They weren't bothering anyone. And this gun advocacy group from the crazy fringe of the gun owners, the loudest ones who are drowning out the debate even within the ranks of gun owners in America, this group, Open Carry Texas, shows up at the outside the restaurant where this gun control group is meeting. And they are just walking around with semi-automatic rifles, with shotguns. This group themselves described them as military-style rifles. And there are photos of them in the parking lot outside this event, just basically brandishing their weapons around. And the manager of the restaurant refused to call 911, even though this was a fairly threatening situation, because the manager thought that this would incite some kind of riot. This Open Carry Texas group also did a follow-up email to the Moms Demand Action group talking about other events that they had been staging around Texas. There was an example here, a direct quote from the Open Carry Texas group that said, "We had a great time today walking through San Antonio with our semi-automatic rifles and shotguns. The best part was the reaction was very positive and supportive. People are getting used to seeing and being around guns, and police have come to accept it and don't even question us anymore. What we are doing is working in society. Society is coming to view the sight of, quote, military-style rifles in public as just another normal thing. Isn't that a good thing?" Here's the problem. That's not a good thing. They are military-style rifles, and they are called that for a reason, because they belong in the military. That is the context within which those guns belong. They do not belong on the streets. They do not belong in the arms of random civilians. And they certainly do not belong out in public, bothering other people who might not want to be around those guns. You know why people are, quote, getting used to seeing that? Because wackos on the fringe are walking around inappropriately carrying these guns, whether it's legal or not. That's part of the question, and they're going and shoving these in people's faces and basically saying that you can get used to it and suck it up, or you can not like it and not say anything about it. And if they show up at events like this at, you know, in Dallas, they show up outside these events where the gun control people aren't even bothering anyone or advocating openly and publicly, and they basically show up just to say, "We're here and you need to get used to it because your opinions are not valid, and the only opinions that are valid are those of the people who are literally carrying lethal weapons in their hands. I don't care if they weren't going to use it. That is automatically, you have crossed a line within a democratic debate when you do that. Normal, rational, sane gun owners, and I know many of them, do not do that. That is not behavior that they consider to be acceptable. But I also don't hear most of them calling this out publicly or telling those other people to be quiet and stop making all of them collectively look bad. That fringe is allowed to say whatever it wants and literally carry around a gun like it's a third world country that doesn't understand how to have a democratic debate so that they can express their opinions and no one else can express their opinions. If you are forced to intimidate people in order to express your opinions and to clarify your points and to hammer home your points, if you are forced to brandish weapons to win your debate, you are not having a debate. You are intimidating your opponents into silence. And that is unacceptable in a democracy. That is utterly unacceptable behavior. It is undemocratic, and it is a far graver assault on our freedoms than any perceived or even imagined threat that the government is coming to take away your guns. I don't even care at this point anymore about specifically advocating for any given policy that's being discussed in terms of gun control, because at this point in this country, we can't even have a discussion. And there was another example that really hammered this home in the past week. The magazine Guns and Ammo, which is a fairly right-wing, very, you know, on the radical side of the gun ownership spectrum there, they've been around for a really long time. They're very proud of the fact that they never moderated when some of the major gun groups like the NRA had kind of briefly moderated for a few decades. They, you know, their position is that they have been consistently in favor of basically unrestricted, unfettered gun access in this country. That's their interpretation of the Second Amendment to the Constitution. And they have, you know, they always have some columns that run in their magazine expressing various thoughts on the Second Amendment or gun ownership or various gun laws or proposals being put in place. And these are kind of these opinion columns. They're not necessarily the views of the editorial board of Guns and Ammo magazine. And they had a very long time, you know, experienced writer, very popular guy, who had the audacity in the December issue that's just come out to write this column saying that he wanted to have a discussion on the idea of having some levels of gun control. He didn't even, again, specifically advocate really for given policies or anything like that. What he said was that, you know, that he was a firm defender of the Second Amendment to the Constitution, but that didn't give a right to irresponsible gun ownership and gun use. He literally used the word, quote, irresponsible, which to me seems completely rational and normal to say that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights do not give you the right to use your freedoms irresponsibly. And the reaction to this was pandemonium from the readership of this magazine, Guns and Ammo. They freaked out. The editor-in-chief, who was planning to step down at the end of the year anyway, has had to move up the timeline of his retirement. He's basically being forced out. He had to issue an apology. He didn't even agree with the editorial itself, but he had agreed to run it, and therefore he had to resign. And he, you know, people were saying they had to fire that columnist, which they did, even though this guy's written for the publication for quite a long time now. They also, you know, had to get rid of this editor, get rid of anyone associated with this article. That again, all it said was that was so controversial was that maybe we should be willing to discuss some gun control to prevent irresponsible use and ownership of guns. Quote, irresponsible, that the Second Amendment does not protect a right to be irresponsible with a power that can literally end people's lives without a court of law or any procedure whatsoever. And the editor, his line was that he said in his resignation statement that where he was apologizing profusely for having run this and tarnished the good name of Guns and Ammo magazine, he said to his readers that he ran the article not because he necessarily agreed with it, but because he was hoping that it would spur a healthy exchange of ideas. That was the phrase he used, a healthy exchange of ideas. So he's being forced out, a columnist is being fired, and the magazine is having to cater to these wacko readers that they've gotten. And I'm sure that they have some reasonable readers, but clearly the majority of the people who are making a hullabaloo about this were not at all reasonable. And these people, there's all this happening because they wanted to spur an exchange of ideas on the notion, the controversial assertion, that your Second Amendment freedoms don't give you the right to use that freedom irresponsibly. We can't have a discussion in this country anymore because one side, or rather one fraction of one side, has swallowed up the entire debate by out-yelling everyone else and by literally waving military-style rifles around in public at people to prevent there from even being a debate. If that's the only way you can hold on, you are doing something wrong, and you're not participating in a democratic society in a responsible manner. These freedoms were supposed to go both ways. They were supposed to protect our society from the government, and they were supposed to protect the society from each other and create a stable, workable, democratic republic in which we could all participate and all function equally. It's been a long time coming. We've been working on trying to perfect this since the Constitution was passed. You know, we got our Bill of Rights passed. We've passed many other amendments. We've given women the right to vote. We've given African Americans and people of other races the right to vote. We've ended slavery. There were a lot of things that we had to work on. But you know, the Bill of Rights that now is supposed to apply to everyone, that's supposed to go both ways. That's supposed to protect our ability to have a democratic society. It's supposed to protect us from the government and from each other. It's supposed to uphold the social contract. It is not freedom if many of us are living in fear that a radical fringe group with military-grade weapons is allowed to control the discussion and keep us silent. And I'm getting frankly tired of that. That is not a democratic society. And you know what? I am tired of just sitting back and taking this. There is more than one opinion on this. I don't even necessarily know if I care at this point who wins the debate. I want us to be able to have a debate. And we can't have a debate. If we can't have a debate on a legitimate policy discussion here, and the only way that they can assert that this is not a legitimate discussion is by waving around guns at people, then it's not a good sign for our democracy. What exactly are they protecting with their fundamental freedom to have and do whatever they want with any guns for any reason at any time without any restriction? If they are busy shutting down the freedom to have a democratic debate on a legitimate policy issue, it doesn't seem to me like they're protecting democracy or protecting our freedom. And frankly, you know, we've got crime rates that have been going down steadily since the 1990s. We've got law enforcement at an all-time high. Things are looking pretty good, but this one very vocal faction has decided to take it upon itself to quote-unquote protect everyone else and themselves from this unnamed, unseen, fictional menace that they have constructed in their heads because they don't think that there should be any curtailment or any curbs or any restrictions on their purported right, unlimited right, to keep and bear arms irresponsibly with no regulations despite the well-regulated militia clause. And frankly, I've had enough. I've had enough. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy for November 12, 2013. The show is recorded in my studio in Newton, Massachusetts weekly and is available for download from billhumphreyresearch.com/radio on Tuesdays. You can also hear a repeat of it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark, or stream it at WVUD.org every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8bitanimal.com. And thanks to my guest expert, Abby Stoddard at humanitarianoutcomes.org. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.